Episode 10, The Hidden Lessons of School, Conclusion. Critical thinking question. What if the only thing we really learn in school is how to get through school? And what if for too many of us that is one of the most destructive things we could possibly learn?
Certain teachers who would hurt the children any way they could, by pouring their derision upon anything we did, exposing every weakness, however carefully hidden by the kid.
Students who are truly gifted or who work exceptionally hard are not given the opportunity to reach their full potential. In reality, it is a system of conformity, not equality. Every student has to be taught the same lesson content in the same manner. We are always trying to influence the education system, trying to change how it is run or what is taught. The result of this is a system that is forever changing and always in flux. Children of all minorities become subject to the prevailing attitudes of the majority at that time. We are told that public schools are the protectors of diversity in society because they bring together so many different cultures under the one system. But how diverse can we expect a society to be if all our children are taught the same thing, the same way? To ensure that no religion or minority is offended, schools teach subjects like history in a factual manner, ignoring the deep-rooted causes of past events and glossing over the lessons to be taken from them. But such lessons are what is important in history. Why bother learning the key dates of Hitler's rise to power if we don't teach children why? Why an entire country cheered a man at every step that he took towards totalitarianism?
So last week, for the first time in over a year and a half, I went inside a public school. Three of them, actually, all in one day. And I'm here to report that it doesn't really look like anything has changed in that time since the last time I visited or observed one of the government schools. And as far as the show is concerned, wouldn't there just be egg all over my chubby little face if some kind of revolution had taken place that I wasn't aware of because I hadn't been there to visit? If they had gotten together and said, listen, we are going to start treating these kids with respect. We are going to start honoring individualism. We are going to start doing everything we can to help maintain that childhood curiosity that is so essential to real, authentic learning. We are going to have classes in philosophy. We're going to have classes in ethics and economics. And that is, of course, if the kids want to take them, because they're also going to be in charge of their entire education. And how about we even stop funding the whole darn thing with theft? But unfortunately, no such revolution has taken place. I spent about an hour and a half of my day, like I said, between three public schools in the Manchester, New Hampshire area. One was actually for a meeting related to a client, and the other two, because I was passing them on my way home, I stopped to drop off some literature related to the SAT service that my company provides. Now, this was actually a point of contention within the company. I really didn't see the point in trying to form these relationships with high school guidance departments in an effort to drive business. My argument basically was, this is not a business-to-business relationship. We have absolutely nothing to offer these people. If I go in and meet with them for 15 minutes, I just basically ate up 15 minutes of essentially their free time. I can't go in there and say, listen, I can make your pension bigger. I can reduce your workload and make you responsible for the big air quotes here, guidance of fewer students. I can magically turn those 3 hours of free time you have every day into 4.5 hours. I can't do anything. I can just hand them stuff and tell them about our service and hope that they are one of the people who are genuinely concerned with helping out their students. But there's no incentive for them to care. If the SAT scores of the students in that school actually go down from one year to another, they still get a raise. So what would they really want to talk to me for? You know, the other thing I found with these people too, and this is mostly in phone conversations, because it's so much easier to be a total dick to somebody over the phone than it is face to face, is this nastiness that gets directed to me because I'm doing something with the intention of making a profit. This is just unconscionable to them. You're supposed to do this coercively. You're not supposed to try and engage in a voluntary relationship to provide some kind of a service. You just force the kids to do it. So you profit seeker. I mean, that's the attitude that I feel like I've encountered whenever I've called into guidance departments just to say, hey, you know, this is a service. We understand that it's supposedly part of your responsibility to inform kids about private service providers for things like standardized testing or general academic support. So I just want to let you know that we exist. And even that simple phone conversation, can I send you something, doesn't always go particularly well because all it is a waste of their time. That's how I really, really feel I get treated when I deal with these people. Like I'm eating into their day. And before I go any further, let me just be extra, extra clear about something. When I'm going in and talking to these people, I hope at this point in the show this is obvious. I am in no way trying to set up some kind of a contract with the school where I would get my hands on one penny of taxpayer money. Anything that comes into my hands from this effort would be based on a later voluntary transaction with the parent where we set up a contract for me to do a service, I do the service, and then my reputation and the reputation of the company hinges on how well the person who contracted with me thinks that I did. And even this interaction sucks a lot of the time, where I'm talking to a parent about what their child needs. I'd much rather, and I'm trying to be better at this, to make more of an effort to do this, to talk to the student about what they need, or want, or don't want. But the school is really, and really the guidance department, is merely a distribution center for information about private services that are available if students or parents want them, sort of predicated on the tragicomically false idea that the people who work in the guidance office are concerned with performance or the future of these students. But it wasn't really too out of my way, so I figured it would be at least worth the little bit of time that it would take to go in there and slap some flyers down on the main desks of the guidance office. As I got in my car and I went up to the building, I thought it would be interesting to do a little experiment. Confirmation bias is easy, especially with public schools. When you're a critic of public schools, it would be very easy for me to walk in that door and find dozens of things wrong within a couple of minutes, especially when looking at the interactions between young people and adults. So I thought I would challenge myself to find something positive that was going on during my trip to government school. So I walk in the building, and I walk down this long corridor that's sort of poorly lit with these intermittent but very harsh fluorescent lights, and it's just these endless rows of lockers that all are exactly the same size, exactly the same color, just this very stale hallway. I come to the end of it to this foyer area, and it looked like it might have been lunchtime or something, because there was this tall man. He might have been a teacher, he might have been a gym teacher, maybe he was just the sort of hallway heavy, but he's herding kids outside through this door. Now, the temperature in New Hampshire was like in the high 20s, low 30s. It was very windy. And kids were stopping and saying, hey, can I just run to my locker and grab my coat? And it's kind of this no questions asked. He's doing this kind of traffic directing motion with his arm. was outside, outside, outside. That was pretty much all he was saying. He didn't have a cattle prod or anything, but it was really the only thing that I could see missing from the interaction with these kids. So that was, you know, I'm trying to find something positive, but this is what I encounter within the first few minutes of being in the building. One of the kids who was being herded out this door, he stops and he looks at the guy. And I'm watching this. I'm standing about 15 feet away watching. He goes, "The only thing colder than the weather outside today is you." Good for that kid. Well said. So I find the guidance office. I do my business. It takes all of 30 seconds. And I'm on my way back out of the building, walking down that same corridor. Now, I pass this window in a classroom door. And if... Well, if you're in school, you know this all too well, but if you're out of school, you might remember that the doors, they had these little rectangular sort of slit windows, and they had that wire inside. It was kind of like a safety caging, so nobody could punch through it and escape. But walking down the hallway and just looking in window after window and seeing these kids' faces through that wire, something about that just made sense when I think about everything that government education is. But one classroom that I walked by, through the little slit, I see a group of about 10 or 12 people sitting around in a circle, and they're smiling and they're laughing. And I slow to look in there, and the teacher is a young guy, probably about my age, and I say, "Well, that looks positive. I wonder what's going on in there." But a couple of them looked at me because I had actually come to a stop in the hallway, so I just moved along and out of the building back to my car. And as I got in my car and I was leaving Manchester, I was thinking about that. I was like, you know, what the hell was going on in that room? That looked like everybody was having a joyful time. I started to think about the age of the teacher, right? He was, like I said, he was a young guy who might have been in his first 5 or so years of teaching. I thought to myself, now I'm trying to be positive, but, you know, sorry. I thought to myself, I wonder what I would see if I went back and looked in that same slit 20 years from now. Would this young, energetic, optimistic teacher who can entertain this room of 10 or 12 kids be the guy in the elastic waistband Dockers who puts on some kind of boring movie and falls asleep at his desk? Because that's what the system does to people who have energy and who think they can make a positive difference in the lives of kids. It beats that out of the educators, too, as we're going to talk a little bit about today. And by the time they retire, most of them are just these old curmudgeons who are like, "Well, this job would be great if it wasn't for these kids." Well, that guy. We all, I think, are familiar with that guy or lady. Because I really don't believe that hardly anybody goes into this profession of teaching with the attitude that, here's a job, no matter how much I suck at it, I can pretty much rely on a $1,500 a year raise until I retire. No matter what I do, as long as I get through the initial probation period, I can really just go bananas after that as far as being lazy, not delivering any kind of quality service. I can really just give up. I don't think that that's what motivates people to work in education. I think they do it because they want to make a positive difference in the lives of young people. It's the system that changes that. They realize that those aren't realistic goals, that they're not going to be able to make a difference. I think that's all too common in the profession of being a public school teacher. I mean, the teachers' union obviously doesn't help this either. Right? I mean, the teacher, public employee unions in general, I mean, their motto is like, "Hey, slow down. You're making the rest of us look bad over here." Same is true with education. I mean, we've all driven by that construction site on the highway where, you know, there's one guy holding a shovel, spade end up, and 19 guys drinking Dunkin' Donuts coffee. Those people work for the state. The same is true with education. There's just no shovel, so to speak. But what I expected my interactions with the guidance people to be, they were. They were kind of like, "Oh, well, thanks. Guess I'll put these in a pile somewhere." And that was pretty much it. Whenever I give things to these people, I feel like I'm saying, "Here, can you just go ahead and throw this away for me?" And of course, you know, I'm not saying that there aren't people who are genuinely concerned with the future of their students and the well-being of their students. I've just never felt like I've encountered one in any of my interactions with these people. And that was my big trip to public schools last week.
But why are the teachers educating these kids not accountable to parents? Well, this is the result of another monopoly, a teachers' union monopoly. Teachers' unions stress that all teachers are to be treated equally. The result of this is that incompetence is tolerated and brilliance goes without reward. Under such a monopoly, what incentive is there for teachers to try harder? So why do we tolerate monopolies like government schools or teachers' unions? After all, we wouldn't tolerate a monopoly in other areas of our lives. What if the government established a monopoly over the clothing or mobile phone industries in your country? The uproar would be enormous. We demand choice, alternatives. After all, competition in a free market has consistently fostered great variety, performance, and prices. Unlike the poor service, overpricing, and limited choice that are typical of monopolies, competition in the market...
I just finished public school, I tell you it's great. Waking up at 6 a.m. to pledge allegiance to the state. Yeah, it's true, I got my public school blues. My teacher likes to yell, he says I'm losing sight. I aced the test but didn't do 500 math problems last night. So I received an F, even though I should have passed. Cause I didn't raise my hand to use the bathroom during class. I just finished public school, I'll tell you why it's grand. Free indoctrination camps that lend a helping hand. You're entrusting the state to fill your child's plate with mindless facts and information they regurgitate. It's comforting to see the high illiteracy rate. Yeah, public school is great. I just finished public school, I tell you why it's fun. You get 10 minutes to eat lunch if you eat and run. At least the food is healthy, they've got all your vegetables, like french fries, onion rings, ketchup and pickles. Public school, what would I do without you? I'd be blue, and I wouldn't get free pickles. I just finished public school, I'll tell you why it's hip. They've got security and cops blocking every exit. And you better not cut class without a hall pass, unless you're wishing for your own funeral mass. These rules they create to protect the inmates, they're for your benefits, so just sit and obey. Public school, you keep me in good mental health, cause without you, I'd have to think for myself, yeah.
That was the song Public School Blues by the very talented Ms. Hannah Hoffman. You can check out more of her work at hhmusic.net. A lot of very entertaining, liberty-themed musical content at that site. I've been meaning to include that song in the show for a while, but I hesitated using it as bumper music because I didn't want to cut it up into two parts or anything. So I wanted to make sure I could slip it in while we were still in this series of the hidden lessons of school, because I thought it fit particularly well there. I said in an earlier episode that if you were going to condense the entire 12-year process of a public education down into 1 3-minute song, it would really have to be the Hokey Pokey. But if you're going to condense School Sucks podcast into a 3-minute song, it would have to be that, I think. All the good information in that song, and my favorite line is probably the one about pickles. Of course, we know that the pickles in government school are not actually free, but it's a great line. And so check out Hannah's work at hhmusic.net. While we're doing this little intermission, I thought it would be a very good opportunity to welcome a whole bunch of new fans and listeners to the show. We have a Facebook fan page that about a week ago had a little less than 400 people on it, and in the past week it shot up to over 900, and this has a lot to do with one listener named Mitch who invited, he said, I think 3,000 of his friends to come join us and check out the page and hopefully check out the show. So if there are a lot of new people listening, and I think there might be a few other new people listening for other reasons, welcome. I hope you're finding the show to be enjoyable. I hope you're finding the web resources that we have at this point to be easy to navigate. We do have a new website coming soon, and I'm always willing to take feedback, willing to take criticism, willing to take suggestions, so please don't hesitate to contact me. If you have been listening and you're really enjoying the show and you just keep asking yourself, boy, what can I do to help this guy? First of all, thanks for the thought. It's greatly appreciated. I always encourage people to leave comments on iTunes. I think that's a great way for other people to see that other people listen to the show, like the show. Voting for the show on Podcast Alley is particularly helpful. It's currently the number one education show on that site. I'd really like to crack that top 10 and see if that is helpful overall to or for exposure. There are, of course, some buttons to donate on Podomatic and on the Help Us Grow tab of schoolsucksproject.com. But, you know, I would say hold off. If you're really compelled to do that, hold off for a couple weeks, because when we start the new website, I'm going to set up some tiers similar to what Free Talk Live does or what Stefan Molyneux does on his website. So maybe we'll do like $2 a month, $4 a month. I'll really try to have a level for everybody. There'll be like an angel investor tier, which is a one-time donation of $100,000. And I'm sure there's somebody listening who's saying, Brett, that's really not prestigious enough for me. So if that's the case, I suggest you check out the Angel Investor Platinum level, which is an automatic monthly debit of $50,000. So like I said, something for everybody. And you know what? While we're talking about that, I also want to extend a thanks to Jason Osborne. Jason, as many of you may know, has done a tremendous amount of work to help shows like Free Talk Live and Gardner Goldsmith's Liberty Conspiracy for a long, long time, and he recently offered his continuous support of the show to help the project grow and expand and reach more people, so that is greatly appreciated as well. One of the things that he did within the past week or so was swap out his ads for his company, SACL CAI, that run on Free Talk Live in order to run red on-air ads for School Sucks Podcast, which is greatly appreciated, and the downloads have spiked considerably from that also. So again, thanks to Jason for doing that. And of course, thanks to everybody else who's donated so far. It has really helped me, Ofer, and Joe, who we are the three people who are kind of working on pushing this project to the next level, have a sense of what we're going to be able to do with as far as building a new website and just kind of what resources we have at our disposal. But we will set up some kind of subscription program in the very near future. So, and anything that anybody does going forward, of course, is greatly appreciated as well. Now, I understand that School Sucks Podcast is not supposed to be a show about School Sucks Podcast, so I will jump right back into what I was doing, but I did think that this was a good opportunity to welcome new people to the show and, of course, to thank the people who've been listening and helping out all along. From what I understand about podcasts, School Sucks Podcast is doing quite well. We have about 21,000 subscribers as I'm recording this. It is the number one show for education on Podomatic. It is the number one show for education on Podcast Alley. It is in the top 50 overall shows on both of those sites, which you're talking about, you know, at least 50 or 60,000 podcasts on each site in total. So thank you, thank you. Thank you, thank you, and back to what we were doing.
We must ask the question, is it in the government's interest to have an intelligent, free-thinking society? Do they want a populace of potential reformers, each with their own ideas on how to improve the status quo? What would happen if citizens started to offer solutions that didn't involve the expansion of government or further taxation? Further, a public school system encourages blind obedience to authority. A child's own judgment is ceded to that of the teacher, and this also has the consequence
now,
of severely...
The goal of today's episode is to bring this series on the hidden lessons of public education to a close for now. We have covered what I consider to be the big three, the most damaging and destructive lessons that are embedded into the curriculum of public education for the individual. Number one is obedience, which is basically the extinguishing of volition and, in a lot of ways, free thought. Two is conformity, which is basically the extinguishing of individuality and that personal uniqueness that we all bring with us into school when we're 5 or 6 years old. And number three is indifference and apathy, which is the extinguishing of that all-important childhood curiosity that is so, so essential to learning things. We've covered all that with several hours of content, but I thought it would be good today to go to Jonathan Taylor Gatto one more time for some reinforcement. As I've mentioned before, Gatto was a public school teacher in New York for some 30 years. He is considered to be a very, very, very good source for the true history and the true intentions of public education. And I think he's been at it now, you know, talking about these things for nearly 20 years. The only thing that I will say, I mean, like Ayn Rand, you're going to have to deal with a few bat turds in every gold mine. Gatto has a tendency to be somewhat collectivistic in his language, using words like the nation, the United States, we, us, our. I'm not really crazy about that. And I might be reading into this a little bit too much, but even though Gatto advocates a free market system for education, he, in his writing, there are these hints of suspicion that he has directed towards anybody who's trying to make a profit. I've seen that. It comes through a little bit in the article that I'm going to read today, but a little bit in other places too. So I just wanted to point those things out, but all in all, it's a good thing that we had Jonathan Taylor Gatto, and we still do have Jonathan Taylor Gatto, to articulate the true intentions behind government schooling. This is probably the last time, for a while anyway, that you're going to hear Gatto's name mentioned on this show, because we're going to be changing directions after this episode. But this piece I'm going to read is called The Sixth Lesson, Schoolteacher. We did three lessons. Gatto has six. So here we go. The Sixth Lesson, Schoolteacher, by Jonathan Taylor Gatto, New York State Teacher of the Year, 1991. Call me Mr. Gatto, please. 26 years ago, having nothing better to do, I tried my hand at school teaching. My license certifies me as an instructor of English language and literature, but that isn't what I do at all. What I teach is school, and I win awards doing it. Teaching means many different things, but six lessons are common to school teaching from Harlem to Hollywood. You pay for these lessons in more ways than you could imagine, so you might as well know what they are. The first lesson I teach is, stay in class where you belong. I don't know who decides that my kids belong there, but that's not my business. The children are numbered, so if any get away, they can be returned to the right class. Over the years, the variety of ways children are numbered has increased dramatically until it is hard to see the human being under the burden of numbers each carries. Numbering children is a very big and profitable business, though what the business is designed to accomplish is elusive. In any case, again, that's not my business. My job is to make the kids like it. Being locked together, I mean, or at the minimum, endure it. If things go well, the kids can't imagine themselves anywhere else. They envy and fear the better classes and have contempt for the dumber classes. So the class mostly keeps itself in good marching order. That's the real lesson of any rigid competition like school. You come to know your place. Nevertheless, in spite of the overall blueprint, I make an effort to urge children to higher levels of test success, promising eventual transfer from the lower-level class as a reward. I insinuate that the day will come when an employer will hire them on the basis of test scores, even though my own experience is that employers are rightly indifferent to such things. I never lie outright, but I've come to see that truth and school teaching are incompatible. The lesson of numbered classes is that there is no way out of your class except by magic. Until that happens, you must stay where you are put. The second lesson I teach kids is to turn off and on like a light switch. I demand that they become totally involved in my lessons, jumping up and down in their seats with anticipation, competing vigorously with each other for my favor. But when the bell rings, I insist that they drop the work at once and proceed quickly to the next workstation. Nothing important is ever finished in my class, nor in any other class I know of. The lesson of bells is that no work is worth finishing, so why care too deeply about anything? Bells are the secret logic of school time. Their argument is inexorable. Bells destroy past and future, converting every interval into a sameness, as an abstract map makes every living mountain and river the same, even though they are not. Bells inoculate each undertaking with indifference. The third lesson I teach you is to surrender your will to a predestined chain of command. Rights may be granted or withheld by authority without approval. As a school teacher, I intervene in many personal decisions, issuing a pass for those I deem legitimate, or initiating a disciplinary confrontation for behavior that threatens my control. My judgments come quick and fast, because individuality is trying constantly to assert itself in my classroom. Individuality is a curse to all systems of classification, a contradiction of class theory. Here are some common ways it shows up. Children sneak away for a private moment in the toilet on the pretext of moving their bowels. They trick me out of a private instant in the hallway on the grounds that they need water. Sometimes free will appears right in front of me in angry children, depressed or exhilarated by things outside my ken. Rights in such things cannot exist for school teachers. Only privileges, which can be withdrawn, exist. The fourth lesson I teach is that only I determine what curriculum you will study. Rather, I enforce decisions transmitted by people who pay me. This power lets me separate good kids from bad kids instantly. Good kids do the tasks I appoint with a minimum of conflict and a decent show of enthusiasm. Of the millions of things of value to learn, I decide what few we have time for. The choices are mine. Curiosity has no important place in my work, only conformity. Bad kids fight against this, of course, trying openly or covertly to make decisions for themselves about what they will learn. How can we allow that and survive as school teachers? Fortunately, there are procedures to break the will of those who resist. This is another way I teach the lesson of dependency. Good people wait for a teacher to tell them what to do. This is the most important lesson of all, that we must wait for other people, better trained than ourselves, to make the meanings of our lives. It is no exaggeration to say that our entire economy depends upon this lesson being learned. Think of what would fall apart if kids weren't trained in the dependency lesson. The social service businesses could hardly survive, including the fast-growing counseling industry, commercial entertainment of all sorts, along with television, would wither if people remembered how to make their own fun. The food services, restaurants, prepared food warehouses would shrink if people returned to making their own meals rather than depending on strangers to cook for them. Much of modern law, medicine, and engineering would go too, the clothing business as well, unless a guaranteed supply of helpless people poured out of our schools each year. We built a way of life that depends on people doing what they are told because they don't know any other way. For God's sake, let's not rock the boat. In Lesson 5, I teach that your self-respect should depend on an observer's measure of your worth. My kids are constantly evaluated and judged. A monthly report, impressive in its precision, is sent to students' home to spread approval or to mark exactly, down to a single percentage point, how dissatisfied with their children parents should be. Although some people might be surprised how little time or reflection goes into making these records, the cumulative weight of the objective-seeming documents establishes a profile of defect, which compels a child to arrive at certain decisions about himself and his future based on the casual judgment of strangers. Self-evaluation, the staple of every major philosophical system that ever appeared on the planet, is never a factor in these things. The lesson of report cards, grades, and tests is that children should not trust themselves or their parents, but must rely on the evaluation of certified officials. People need to be told what they are worth. In Lesson 6, I teach children that they are being watched. I keep each student under constant surveillance, and so do my colleagues. There are no private spaces for children. There is no private time. Class change lasts 300 seconds to keep promiscuous fraternization at low levels. Students are encouraged to tattle on each other, even to tattle on their parents. Of course, I encourage parents to file their own child's waywardness, too. I assign homework, so this surveillance extends into the household, where students might otherwise use the time to learn something unauthorized, perhaps from a father or mother, or by apprenticing to some wiser person in the neighborhood.
The lesson of constant surveillance is that no one can be trusted, that privacy is not legitimate. Surveillance is an ancient urgency among certain influential thinkers. It was the central prescription set down by Calvin in the Institutes, by Plato in the Republic, by Hobbes, by Comte, and by Francis Bacon. All these childless men discovered the same thing. Children must be closely watched if you want to keep a society under central control. It is the great triumph of schooling that even among the best of my fellow teachers, and among even the best parents, is only a small number who can imagine a different way to do things. Yet only a very few lifetimes ago, things were different in the United States. Originality and variety were common currency. Our freedom from regimentation made us the miracle of the world. Social class boundaries were relatively easy to cross. Our citizenry was marvelously confident, inventive, and able to do many things independently, to think for themselves. We were something all by ourselves, as individuals. It takes only about 50 contact hours to transmit basic literacy and math skills well enough that kids can be self-teachers from then on. The cry for basic skills practice is a smokescreen behind which schools preempt the time of children for 12 years and teach them the 6 lessons I've just taught you. We've had a society increasingly under central control in the United States since just before the Civil War. The lives we lead, the clothes we wear, the food we eat, and the green highway signs we drive by from coast to coast are products of this central control. So too, I think, are the epidemics of drugs, suicide, divorce, violence, cruelty, and the hardening of class into caste in the U.S., products of the dehumanization of our lives, the lessening of individual and family importance that central control imposes. Without a fully active role in community life, you cannot develop into a complete human being. Aristotle taught that. Surely he was right. Look around you or look in the mirror. That is the demonstration. School is an essential support system for a vision of social engineering that condemns most people to be subordinate stones in a pyramid that narrows to a control point as it ascends. School is an artifice which makes such a pyramidal social order seem inevitable, although such a premise is a fundamental betrayal of the American Revolution. In colonial days, and through the period of the early republic, we had no schools to speak of, and yet the promise of democracy was beginning to be realized. We turned our backs on this promise by bringing to life the ancient dream of Egypt, a compulsory training in subordination for everybody. Compulsory schooling was the secret Plato reluctantly transmitted in the republic when he laid down the plans for total state control of human life. The current debate about whether we should have a national curriculum is phony. We already have one, locked up in the 6 lessons I've told you about and a few more I've spared you. This curriculum produces moral and intellectual paralysis, and no curriculum of content will be sufficient to reverse its bad effects. What is under discussion is a great irrelevancy. How did these awful places, these schools, come about? As we know them, they are the product of two, quote, Red Scares of 1848 and 1919, when powerful interests feared a revolution among our industrial poor. And partly, they are the result of the revulsion with which old-line families regarded the waves of Celtic, Slavic, and Latin immigration and the Catholic religion after 1845. And certainly a third contributing cause can be found in the revulsion with which the same families regarded the free movement of Africans through the society after the Civil War. Look again at the 6 lessons of school. This is training for permanent underclasses, people who are to be deprived forever of finding the center of their own special genius. And it is training shaken loose from its original logic to regulate the poor. Since the 1920s, the growth of the well-articulated school bureaucracy and the less visible growth of the horde of industries that profit from schooling exactly as it is have enlarged schooling's original grasp to seize the sons and daughters of the middle class. Is it any wonder Socrates was outraged at the accusation that he took money to teach? Even then, philosophers saw clearly the inevitable direction of the professionalization of teaching, preempting the teaching function that belongs to all in a healthy community. Belongs indeed most clearly to yourself, since nobody else cares as much about your destiny. Professional teaching tends to another serious error. It makes things that are inherently easy to learn, like reading, writing, and arithmetic, difficult, by insisting they be taught by pedagogical procedures.
With lessons like the ones I teach day after day, is it any wonder that we have the national crisis we face today? Young people indifferent to the adult world and to the future, indifferent to almost everything except the diversion of toys and violence. Rich or poor, school children cannot concentrate on anything for very long. They have a poor sense of time, past and to come. They are mistrustful of intimacy, like the children of divorce they really are. They hate solitude. They are cruel, materialistic, dependent, passive, violent, timid in the face of the unexpected, addicted to distraction. All the peripheral tendencies of childhood are magnified to a grotesque extent by schooling, whose hidden curriculum prevents effective personality development. Indeed, without exploiting the fearfulness, selfishness, and inexperience of children, our schools could not survive at all, nor could I as a certified school teacher. Critical thinking is a term we frequently hear these days as a form of training which will herald a new day in mass schooling. It certainly will if it ever happens. No common school that actually dared to teach the use of dialectic, heuristic, or other tools of free minds could last a year without being torn to pieces. Institutional school teachers are destructive to children's development. Nobody survives the 6-lesson curriculum unscathed, not even the instructors. The method is deeply and profoundly anti-educational. No tinkering will fix it. In one of the great ironies of human affairs, the massive rethinking that schools require would cost so much less than we are spending now that it is not likely to happen. First and foremost, the business I am in is a jobs project and contract letting agency. We cannot afford to save money, not even to help children. At the pass we've come to historically, and after 26 years of teaching, I must conclude that one of the only alternatives on the horizon for most families is to teach their own children at home. Small, deinstitutionalized schools are another. Some form of free market system for public schooling is the likeliest place to look for answers. But the near impossibility of these things for the shattered families of the poor and for too many on the fringes of economic middle class foretell that the disaster of the 6-lesson schools is likely to continue. After an adult lifetime spent in teaching school, I believe the method of schooling is the only real content it has. Don't be fooled into thinking that good curricula or good equipment or good teachers are the critical determinants of your son or daughter's school time. All the pathologies we've considered come about in large measure because the lessons of school prevent children from keeping important appointments with themselves and their families to learn lessons in self-motivation, perseverance, self-reliance, courage, dignity, and love, and of course lessons in service to others, which are among the key lessons of home life. 30 years ago, things could still be learned in the time left after school, but television has eaten most of that time, and a combination of television and the stresses peculiar to two-income or single-parent families have swallowed up most of what used to be family time. Our kids have no time left to grow up fully human, and only thin soil wastelands to do it in. A future is rushing down upon our culture, which will insist that all of us learn the wisdom of non-material experience. This future will demand, as the price of survival, that we follow a pace of natural life economical in material cost. These lessons cannot be learned in schools as they are. School is like starting life with a 12-year jail sentence in which bad habits are the only curriculum learned. I teach school and win awards doing it. I should know. Now, one of the other reasons why I felt that it was important to include this article by Gatto before we move on is I think it sheds a little bit of extra light on one of the great tragedies of public education, and that is that so many people who are involved in this, what he lays out in such an obvious way, the people who are involved in this are completely unaware of what they are doing, or they've trained themselves as educators to completely ignore it or rationalize it. And when we look at the pile of ash and rubble, so to speak, that used to be a creative, free-thinking individual prior to entering school, most of us would say, what the hell could you possibly expect to build on top of that? But in government school, there's an answer to this question. What is built on top of this wreckage is an illusion.
It's a fantasy that somebody who has been taught, trained, to be apathetic and dependent will find very comforting. It's the illusion of an all-powerful, all-knowing, and of course, caring and well-intentioned system of authority that will carry us through adulthood, called the state. And the construction of this fantasy somehow occurs simultaneously with the demolition of the individual. And the series of myths that are necessary to prop up this illusion of a well-intentioned and completely necessary system of authority like the state will be the next thing that we address and deconstruct on School Sucks Podcast. And while I know that the listenership of the show has been pulled in a number of different directions, to the young people who are still involved in this process, look closely at how destructive this really is. Take away all of the extracurriculars that are sprinkled over the reality. Of course, remembering that all of those activities follow the same model of obedience, conformity, and disempowerment that the rest of school does. And realize that all you're learning in school is how to get through school. Essentially, how to push yourself as a raw material efficiently through a processing plant that was built long ago to emerge at the other end as the product preferable to elites and central planners who have entirely different goals than you, who do not know you, and who do not give a flying fuck about you. It's a process of learning how to withstand and survive a litany of useless information, a barrage of intellectual insults, forced boredom, imposed responsibilities, the suppression of yourself, constant assaults on your identity, constant assaults on your self-esteem, the acceptance of arbitrary roles, arbitrary labels, and arbitrary estimations of your intelligence and your worth. School is a prison for your thoughts, for your ambitions, for your senses, and for your imagination. It's a prison where conclusions are constantly being superimposed over places and situations where there should be absolutely nothing but questions. It's a prison that will make your adult life look comparatively free, while at the same time completely obscuring any understanding of what real freedom is. If you're in a place where you still have to endure any kind of health class or dare class, here's something that you could try. When they're talking about the horrors of drugs, what drugs do to your mind, what drugs do to your ambition, to your self-esteem, to your ability to think clearly, take out the word drugs and replace it with the phrase government school. And suddenly, you're being told the truth about what is happening to you. Not that drugs are good either. And at this point, I think it's also worth saying that because of the content that we've covered so far, School Sucks Podcast doesn't seem to be too heavy on solutions to these problems. We've really just talked about problems. And I promise you that that will not be the tone of the whole show. When everything is said and done with this project, it will be much more about finding solutions than identifying and talking about problems. But I think that it's also worth saying that while my professional experience and my studies do put me in a position where I believe the things that I have to say about the history of public education and the monstrous intentions behind it should be taken seriously, I do not feel like I am in a position to lay out some kind of definite path for people once they know all this, although I do have a few ideas. Obviously, I would strongly, strongly recommend that it is something that is not self-destructive, that it is obviously not forceful, and that a lot of thought and time goes into whatever decision leads to an action. And will some young people
might find much of what we've talked about on this show so far to be incredibly frustrating. I would point out that the path to becoming a free person starts with the identification of the underhanded tricks that others are using to try and enslave you, as well as an illustration of the traps that you need to start climbing out of. In closing today, I think if one of the intellectuals or central planners who were behind the foundation, the growth, or the maintenance of the government-run education system in America were able to speak openly and honestly with you for a moment about what they were doing, they would assure you that this is not a conspiracy. No one is targeting you personally as an individual. But if such a system was not in place, they might tell you, millions of individuals like you would realize how unique, imaginative, capable, and brilliant they actually are. And then many of you would probably become very, very dangerous to the most vile, predatory, and exploitatious people who walk the earth, who throughout history always seem to be the most powerful. Among the people who are in some way involved in pursuing a path to liberty, there's a lot of different language that's used. Free state, free world, but it starts with a free self. And I sincerely hope that this series about the hidden lessons of public education has been helpful in pointing out the obstacles that have been built in your way.